Thank you for listening so intently throughout this hearing. I'll get to the point. Over the last 3 weeks, I've been struck by just how inappropriate an organisation the church is to have charge or care of children and vulnerable adults. Personally, I would not want my son to spend a moment in the company of a member of this organisation. Its lack of a coherent structure, the possibility of clerics carving out places where they can abuse, the ability to blame one another, the defensiveness, the lack of accountability are just a few criticisms. This is an organisation which, were it a school, it would have been closed down a long time ago. Issues of the status of the church and in the constitution and other province of others, and I see no reason why the church cannot continue doing its good work in other sectors, but on safeguarding, there has to be a case for, to use the words of Adina Carmi, deconstructing and then reconstructing with appropriate checks and balances. Whilst I appreciate you must reserve judgment on the Anglican Church until the final inquiry, scheduled to 2019, it appears to me and the core participants that I represent that the Anglican Church has proved itself incapable of self-governance in the care of children. We reject the flaccid policies, apologetic language, excuses and promises of action in the future. Myself and members of MACSAS have worked to point all these issues out for many years, but have been met only with listening ears and half-hearted engagement. The time has come for action. So what have we heard? We've heard a catalogue of lamentable failures in Chichester and at national level. A15, the first witness, a survivor of abuse by the army chaplain, Gordon Rideout, who later worked as a priest in the Diocese of Chichester, explained how she had been abused by Rideout as a young girl. She explained how powerless she felt during a court-martial process in 1972, in which Rideout had been acquitted. He was later convicted in 2012. Phil Johnson then told us his story of having been extensively groomed by Roy Cotton and others, of safeguarding failures, and of the danger caused to others by the police investigation having been starved of evidence by Wallace Benn. He explained his attempts to bring failures to light and how he had gone to extraordinary lengths in search of the truth, which was never volunteered by the church. Mr. Johnson feels that diocesan safeguarding advisers should be completely independent. There should be an independent system for providing counselling support to be introduced and paid for by the church, and that culture change, importantly, will only come via legislation and criminal sanctions. Overall, Mr. Johnson's life has been blighted, but he has tried to turn his experience into a positive change by encouraging the church to behave better towards survivors. On one final note, he reflected that he often thinks about the person he would have been if the abuse hadn't shaped his life, and the missed opportunities. Shirley Hosgood, she felt that it was not safe to appoint a youth worker and when Bishop Wallace said that he was a personal friend, he tried to change her view. She explained that it had been a difficult telephone conversation with Wallace Benn. She felt the diocese had not learnt the lessons of Cotton and Pritchard. She complained that permissions to officiate were being given without looking at the blue files. There were communication failings. Wallace Benn had been angry with her, and that this stifled communication. Eventually, Shirley Hosgood was denied access to an important safeguarding crisis meeting, and she felt so sidelined that she resigned. Bishop John Hind had two area bishops. We heard that he failed to supervise their activities and allowed them almost free rein in their parts of the diocese. He confirmed he would not break the seal of confessional, even for child abuse cases. He refused to take responsibility for action or inaction in the area of Wallace Benn's, that's Lewis. He now wishes he'd given dowsers and safeguarding advisors unfettered access to blue files much earlier. He explained how in 2001, with the Data Protection Act coming into force, he organised staff to take out ephemera from blue files. This is significant and perhaps not unconnected with the fact that there was a 27-year black hole in Roy Cotton's blue file. John Hine told us that there was definitely collusion and conspiracy taking place among abusing clergy in the East, that is Lewis. It was clear people were working in concert, to quote his words. Philip Jones had been the archdeacon. He told us that there came a point when he became aware that Wallace Benn had misled him. And when he knew about what he knew about Cotton's 1954 conviction, Wallace Benn had told him he only knew in 2001, but it emerged that he had known during the currency of the earlier police investigation. Alana Lawrence, the former chair of MAXAS, set out her work in MAXAS and her compilation of The Stones Cry Out and recommendations. Those recommendations accord with the ones that I make on behalf of the core participants that I represent. We heard from Roger Meekings. I won't repeat his evidence, save to say that he was a thorough and meticulous reviewer. The notion that he somehow missed crucial evidence related to Bishop Peter Ball and, in fact, George Bell is probably inconceivable. If it had been available to him, he would have noticed it. Ian Gibson worked as the bishop's chaplain in 2004. He was responsible for filing. He found the files in disarray. Permissions to officiate were being granted without blue files being checked. 90% of clergy and staff didn't have a CRB check. He found a separate cabinet a file for Peter Ball. He was also present when Wallace Benn asked John Hine to hold back the blemish ride out CRB. Bishop Wallace called Ian Gibson a liar and denied the incident. Janet Hind was undoubtedly a sincere her evidence and her efforts, but she admitted making mistakes on some safeguarding matters. She drew up the safeguarding policy in 1996, and she was overruled on the issue of Michael Walsh in the 1990s, and she produced her note of the case. On Robert Coles, he had admitted to Nicholas Reed, the archdeacon, who told Mrs. Hind. She admits she should have told the police, but didn't. She assumed everyone else would have told the police. Unfortunately, everyone else presumed that she had told the police. Edmund Hick of Sussex Police agreed that if he'd had known of the conviction of Cotton during the first investigation, his complexion would have been different. He said it was routine to get previous convictions on arrest. He added that if he had known about the 2003 complaint, the file would have been reopened at that stage. Sadly, it had been destroyed. It had later been destroyed. He said the diocese seemed to resent statutory authorities, and the police and other safeguarders had to drag them into the 21st century. He said it had been hard at times. He later worked on the Diocesan Safeguarding Advisory Group, which was disbanded. He suspected that he and others on the group were being a nuisance. He was effectively sacked for bringing his professional expertise to bear and being involved in the disciplinary action of Wallace Benn. Wallace Benn complained bitterly that Roger Meekings had turned speculation into fact, to use his words. When it was put to Wallace Benn that he had agreed with the chronology setting out his knowledge of Cotton's activities, which included him knowing about the 1954 conviction in 1998, he said, "I was busy at the time and only gave it a cursory look. I corrected it later in 2008. Wallace Benn maintained he didn't know about Cotton's conviction until he saw Cotton's declaration in 2001. He maintains that any paralysis from the diocese was self-induced. He said that he had inherited a paedophile ring of priests. Overall, he said, "I could have done some things better, but I was cleared of the CDMs made against me." He regarded the safeguarding advisor's criticism of him as nitpicking. Rupert Bursell had been a commissary of the Archiepiscopal Visitation. Its findings were, in summary, that the diocese was slow to identify abuse taking place, dysfunction caused mainstream reports of abuse to be sidelined, and safeguarding was not at the forefront of the diocesan agenda. We heard from Julie McFarlane, a survivor and law professor, who recounted her abuse and the difficulties she faced with the adversarial civil justice system. She and many other core participants I represent found the processes re-traumatizing, especially the hostile adversarial psychiatric assessments. Bishop Mark Sowerby identified a subculture which accepted sexual abuse of children around Lewis. There were basic patterns that he'd identified involving Anglo-Catholics, mainly not married. Most abusers were single and looked out for each other. They were a tribe. If threatened, they responded by defending one another regardless of the threat, even if it was an allegation of child sex abuse. Bishop Martin Warner doesn't want to see safeguarding go to an independent body on the basis that he wants parishes to take responsibility. Martin Warner would like to see a laminated card with the top 10 safeguarding issues rather than a long book. He thinks he should explore what can be done with a website. He doesn't think mandatory reporting is the way to protect children. On the confessional, he wants to keep it in its present form as it enables disclosure and the unburdening of survivors. The former Archbishop Rowan Williams confirmed that despite the abuse allegations emanating from the Catholic Church around the turn of the century, he mistakenly thought that the problem was far smaller in the Anglican Church. The past cases review press release read to the effect, "We have done a thorough review and we are certain that the church has no problem cases." Rowan Williams admitted that this was an ambitious statement. In our view, it was entirely misleading. On a confessional, he's in favour of preserving the seal, as he says it allows vulnerable people to use the space. He admits we can't know how big the problem is due to the secret nature of the conversations. Under his watch, the church seems to have wasted around £2 million on the ill-conceived review, the past cases review, which only identified 13 problematic cases from 40,000 reviewed. Even a fraction of this figure of £2 million could have provided significant amounts of support for survivors. Bishop Nicholas Reed, on Roy Cotton, he told Wallace Benn about the police investigation into him in December 1997. Nicholas Reed took no further action until 12 months later when Cotton told him his ordination had been postponed due to earlier trouble, the organ loft issue. He didn't say that there had been a conviction. Nicholas Reed, to that, said, "It didn't occur to me to ask about the conviction. I take priests at their word. The idea of a priest telling lies to a bishop horrifies me." This typifies how the present system relies on trust and why reporting should be mandated. On the issue of Robert Coles, he tried to minimise the seriousness of the sexual assault of the boy by Rideout as a way of justifying not reporting the confession that Coles had made to him, and despite him being aware that Coles had made a no-comment interview to the police. "He never admitted rape," were his words. He felt Eric Kemp should have made the decision. Colin Perkins was clearly getting on with his work within what we consider to be a flawed system. We had the impression that his system works because of him taking the issues seriously, whereas in other dioceses with weaker DSAs or more forceful bishops, the same mistakes as Chichester can occur. Chichester is often now held up as a beacon of good practice. This has not happened out of a desire for the church to change and improve. It is a reaction to the crisis and has been driven by the pressure and determination of survivors in their fight for justice. Sir Roger Singleton was critical of the past cases review, its methodology, and how it created a false rosy picture about the safeguarding problems of the church. He made the point that files are very poorly kept, the press statement on the case, past cases review, was under-evidenced, to use his words. A8 and A7 described in detail how they had been groomed, abused by Peter Ball, and again the difficulties they had faced with the civil justice system. Bishop David Walker explained that there's no outside control of religious communities. Graham Tilby explained in great detail, and sometimes in management speak, the efforts made to improve the system in the church, notably on training and the ability of DSAs to overrule bishops. There was criticism that improvements were slow and that following guidance is still not mandated. Adina Carmi recounted her findings that there were unacceptable practices at the cathedral and then a resistance to allow her to do her work and then attempts to destroy all copies of her report. A11, the boy chorister who had been abused by Terence Banks, suffered with debilitating mental health issues. He complained again of the harmful nature of the compensation system. Dean Peter Atkinson said, and I quote, "I can see John Tregold would have been defensive with the police. At the time of his retirement, he burned a number of files. He had left the deanery and returned, removed files from the basement and had a bonfire in the garden. I don't know what the files were. They might have been chapter files, but they could have been his own. He did find it odd and told the police." Elizabeth Hall, the former National Safeguarding Advisor, gave her opinion that this could happen anywhere, not just in Chichester. People can abuse in plain sight, and these men are obsessed with creating safe spaces for them to abuse in, and to take care to carve out these spaces. In questioning by Mr. Frank, and asked about document AC006654, which relates to the Bishop of Peterborough having a massive bonfire of documents when he retired, she said that there's a theological underpinning for this, to give the successor a fresh start. She's also aware that clergy remove and keep documents in their attics after retirement. Justin Welby agreed that he has no real power and can only use his influence. He was non-specific in his views on many of the suggested changes. Bishop Peter Hancock agreed with him that the man in the street would not know what giving due regard means legally and thinks there should be a change to clarify this. He agreed there should be a separate procedure on capability in the CDM. He agrees that DSAs should be recruited nationally and work locally. He says that discussions are starting on a redress scheme. He agrees the seal of the confessional should not apply to child abuse. He's working on improvements to monitor PTOs, including a register with Crockford's. He refused to agree that the church should implement mandatory reporting, instead stating that it is everyone's responsibility throughout the country to report. He feels the church is as close as it can be to mandatory reporting. So I return to my opening submissions, in which I mentioned that there are four essential ingredients that have prevented good responses from the church. And these apply to many organisations. Their internal rules, firstly. Secondly, hierarchical structures. Thirdly, church culture. And fourthly, the church's unincorporated status. On internal rules, we've heard that the development of internal rules within dioceses has been haphazard, with Janet Hine committing them to paper in 1996 and 7, and not until 2004 did we see basic national rules. Over the last 2 years, we've seen a torrent of new internal guidance. We question whether DSAs actually have the power to overrule the bishop due to their employer-employee relationship. Mandatory reporting is still a long way off for the church. Even the October 2017 rules still only require due regard to be taken to the guidance. It should be noted that at every turn you have heard bishop after bishop find ways to keep oversight structures in-house. There has been strenuous resistance of external oversight in the face of the evidence. Colin Perkins is held up as a model of how things are all right now, but the reality is that the church does not have a Colin Perkins in every diocese. Systems have to be designed to be operated by mediocre or even poor employees. In our view, the church's systems are inadequate on almost all levels. The CDM has been exposed as a hopelessly cumbersome instrument with impenetrable rules. No one has successfully been disciplined for failing to report abuse. It has been shown to be not fit for purpose in safeguarding matters. Some changes have been made, but a vulnerable complainant has firstly to be aware that it exists, and then to be able to interpret the rules. There is a need for independent arbitration and a child abuse procedure. Permission to officiate is still open to abuse. The lack of mandatory reporting has allowed Chichester cover-ups and failures to take place. All bishops and diocesan safeguarding advisers would have been required to report, yet we have heard of repeated failures to alert the police. Centralised rules on records need to be stringent, and there needs to be document retention. Again, these need to be fully mandated. We've heard of files being filleted, that safeguarding reports could have been thrown away. We've heard of at least two bonfires of papers, and that this may have been a widespread practice at the end of bishops' times in office. On hierarchical structures, the Church of England operates a highly hierarchical structure, with the diocesan bishops sitting at the top of a pyramid and having the say on all matters related to safeguarding. Whilst an attempt has been made to dilute this structure with the implementation and powers for DSAs, it would take a brave and self-confident DSA to overrule a bishop, and they still owe their actual employment to the bishops and could find themselves bypassed if bishops do not agree with their decisions. On church culture, we've heard of cultures of deference, factional cultures, Anglo-Catholics, evangelicals, tribes, middle ground being shut out. We've certainly seen egos on display. Wallace Benn, Philip Jones, and Nicholas Reed were certainly no shrinking violets. These differing cultures created conflict in Chichester. They are no doubt causing problems elsewhere right now throughout the country. However, the most important culture in the church is the defensive culture. None of our complainant witnesses have described having been welcomed and assisted at any point by church officials. Instead, there were attempts at all levels to minimise the seriousness and volume of cases. For instance, Rowan Williams' evidence on the past cases review, which was in fact an attempt to minimise the problem. Julia McFarlane's legal claim was resisted on the basis that she was out of time and consented to it. There have been repeated attempts to resist Phil Johnson's questions to get to the truth. The church at national level was prepared at one point to sacrifice Bishop John Hines to minimise the spread and to protect Rowan Williams. We've heard of some skullduggery around Peter Ball, which we'll hear more of in July, particularly around the Tyler report. The Halliday and Waddington cases elsewhere demonstrate that this is happening in other dioceses. The church and Justin Welby may have you believe that most of this is caused by having a hapless, disorganised and disjointed structure. In reality, the evidence demonstrates that the church institutions have worked in concert to resist cases. It could be said that the Catholic Church's more brazen approach to resisting cases, due to their written rules on secrecy, is actually less malign than the Anglican resistance, which has required conscious effort to treat survivors badly. On unincorporated status, we've heard that the church is a very loose structure of unincorporated bodies and individuals with no strict system or control. They are not corporate and so not accountable. Better responses and serious attention to good safeguarding will only be achieved through serious sanctions such as fines, withdrawal of charitable status, or closure of the offending organisation. Our recommendations to remedy this issue or these issues are set out here. It will be for the panel to decide on the evidence, but on behalf of the core participants I represent, we will be asking the panel to look at the following issues and to make those as recommendations. That the Anglican Church is unable effectively to respond to child sex abuse risks. What is required is legislation to introduce mandatory reporting. Legislation is also required to introduce an independent statutory body to enforce basic standards of safeguarding. the statutory body would establish a register of institutions fit to look after children. It would be an offence to look after children without being on the register. To be on the register, the institution would have to introduce a corporate structure. The registered institution should be forced to adhere to minimum standards of safeguarding regulation. The independent body would have the power to prosecute organisations for breaches of the regulations. Fines would be imposed for breaches. Organisations could be prevented from working with children. All complaints would be passed to an independent body by any receiving institution with a criminal sanction for failing to pass them on. The body would gather information from complainants, regulated institutions and third parties. It would have the power to compel disclosure of material. The body would liaise with and assist civil authorities such as the police and social services. The body would ensure that that the police and other statutory organisations take appropriate action within reasonable timescales. The body would investigate complaints using a balance of probability standard of proof. There'd be no statute of limitations under this scheme. The independent body would have the power to make awards of compensation similar to the CICA. It would have the power to decide on the support to be offered to a complainant, and a scheme would be established to provide adequate compensation, taking into account the effect on quality of life and a series of other factors. Complainants would be allowed to take advice from lawyers, and a contribution to legal costs would be awarded. The cost of the body's work would be paid from a levy on institutions, and those culpable would pay for the costs of dealing with individual cases in which they're involved. Having heard a great deal of evidence, panel, there may be instances in which criminal offences have been brought out during the evidence, and I know that Sussex Police have spoken with Mr. Scora about one such instance which they are going to follow up, and I'm grateful for that. I ask the team and the panel to be mindful of those when they review the evidence when considering potential recommendations. I also ask the panel to consider a recommendation that after ICSA is gone, that a permanent commission of inquiry is set up to investigate elsewhere in the church and other similar unregulated bodies. Thank you, panel.